What is up, punks? It's Shinobi, and we're bringing you Block Digest episode 227 at block height 637,708 on Saturday, July 4th. So, happy 4th of July, and what's going on, Janine?
Or as the British say, happy Trader Day.
Well, whichever side of the pond you're on. But, yeah, so putting the news desk together today, I realized that like 90% of this episode today is in one way or another related to Lightning Network.
There's a lot of stuff happening.
I don't think we've ever had an episode that was like almost this homogenous of like a topic distribution before.
Yep. It's also much shorter than usual.
That is a breath of fresh air and relief. But yeah, I guess you want to take us into the first big announcement?
Yeah, so in episode 209, back in February, we highlighted Jack Mahler's announcement of the Strike app with the tagline, "What if you could pay a Lightning invoice with your debit card? What if your bank account could speak Bitcoin?" And it has finally arrived. On July 2nd, Jack tweeted, "A new Bitcoin era is born. Lightning Strike beta is available for all to download. Your debit card can now pay Lightning invoices, and your bank account now speaks Bitcoin, ready for liftoff." And then he linked to a kind of announcement post and said, "Yo, today's the day, and even though much of my post will be about today, it's important to quickly address how we got here. Strike is the direct result of years of Bitcoin plus Lightning development, countless hours of unnumbered conference calls with lawyers, infinite meetings with banking partners, and many sleepless nights have all led us to today." And so Strike will be available on iOS, Android, and Chrome, and basically what it allows you to do is, as it says, they are interact with Bitcoin and the Lightning Network using an app that's connected to a bank account and or debit card. And this is not a wallet that you will need to back up a seed or manage channels or do liquidity management or swaps and all of that. Basically, you just download the app, link your bank account, and scan. And then they also have this kind of social media profile thing. Like he kind of demonstrates an example of that with his own profile in the post. Oops. Okay. I thought you were saying I was barely audible. Yeah. Lots of cat sounds. Anyway. Yeah. So you, basically, now I got messed up because I freaked out.
Sorry.
There's a kind of a social media feature aspect to it where you can create a profile that other people using the app can pay to. It kind of also implied that you could pay to the profile from an account that wasn't with Strike, because you mentioned other wallet services, including custodial service, that I guess work with Strike. And part of the demonstration that he made in the post is to show his own profile on Strike and also the profile of Black Lives Matter, which he's going to be accepting donations to just as part of a launch and promotion thing. But for me, the most interesting part of the story, and given this is an app that most, the intent is to, connect your bank account, which granted it's given the state of things, it's like extremely hard to avoid doing any kind of KYC with that. And I think everyone knew about that going in, but he kind of provided this little short story about how he was, sitting in a Chicago high rise in his hoodie, listening to what he calls suit man lawyer guy, tell him about how much KYC AML they would have to comply with. And then he says, according to research that he conducted later, they didn't really have to do that much. Now, one caveat here that I kind of want to make, as I was preparing the story, I think the data collection and sharing involved with the app, especially involving their verification partner Cognito, is a bit more complicated than this announcement and their privacy policy kind of lets on, because people will look at, oh, only needs a name and phone number. Whereas the suit man lawyer guy was like listing off all of the traditional things that, a bank would ask from you, which is like your address, sometimes utility bills, a tax ID, all kinds of things. And he says they only needed a name and phone number. But I think it's a bit more complicated than that because, like I said, they have this third party verification partner called Cognito, and that they have that in their privacy policy. And I'm a big fan of not only disclosing your third party partners that may access user data, but I'm also a fan of being upfront with people about what parts of your service a person can use before they might trigger additional KYC requests. And so an app, may be KYC free or KYC light at lower thresholds or for certain features, but they might amp that up when you use other features. And so I was under the impression that it was possible to use the app with nothing more than a name and phone number, as he says, as long as you aren't connecting a bank account. Because when you connect a bank account, like I said, it's very hard to avoid KYC requirements because you're connecting to the traditional anti-privacy banking system. And so that's why I was thinking that it would be KYC by default, if you were using like the social profile feature to accept Bitcoin. But then if you connect it to a bank account, maybe there's additional stuff that they might ask of you. But regardless, I think it's important that if it's not the, if that is not the case, if there that distinction isn't there, then people should be aware of that. They should be aware of whether also their phone number is being used to go to some data broker or background check service to request more personal information, even though Strike is not necessarily asking for that information directly. And I also want to say that some people, even if more information is collected, they may not have a problem with that because some people can take more risks or are willing to take more risk when it comes to their personal information, and that's up to them. I minimize my risk as much as possible. And that's why I always prefer, or lately I've been preferring to use the term informational self-determination instead of privacy, because it's not immediately clear to people or understandable to people that privacy as a whole is not about keeping secrets. It's about consent and being informed about where your personal information goes and how it's being used. And so I'm going to be looking more into how that works because it's not immediately clear to me how all of that fits in, but I am really like, it did make me happy reading the announcement that, Jack didn't, he obviously didn't take the advice of the as he referred to it, what was it? The lawyer, what was the nickname that he used?
Suit, Mr. Suit Lawyer Guy.
Suit man lawyer guy. So he didn't just take suit man lawyer guy's advice about how much they would have to do. He did try to resist that and mitigate it as much as possible, and maybe he didn't mitigate it as much as people would like, but I am glad that he did try and that he shared the fact that he tried and that he thinks it's still important.
Yeah, and it's Really, I just like a little more like clarity on those things, but it really does seem to me like a threshold-based thing, like you were saying. And I mean, at the end of the day, like I was fully expecting this to be a KYC thing where somebody out there is getting your like a lot more personal information than that. I mean, like it hooks up to your bank account, you know what I mean? But, you know, that said, I still personally plan to use this service. And I think this is a very useful thing that was inevitably going to happen. And, you know, it comes down to use it if you want, use it if you don't want. And what I like about that is like, this is the first thing I have seen forming other than Cash App. Who's trying to do it right, in my opinion, and Coinbase, who is just fucking it up left and right, of a business trying to be a Bitcoin bank. And like Jack has completely taken that to a whole new level, doing it with Lightning rather than just on chain. Because, you know, the way this is that this is a back-end payment rail infrastructure that seamlessly links, you know, your fiat bank account, the Lightning Network, and the Lightning Network itself can seamlessly bridge itself to the chain. So it's just created this seamless three-way payment rail that can just facilitate seamless economic transacting between all three of those different things. And I'm sure that given the nature of having to deal with dynamic fiat Bitcoin interactions, like that there is hedging going on in the background. Like there is some kind of trading activity that is required to operate this business because you're going to need more Bitcoin as this volume builds up. And I'm sure Jack will find some way to generate extra profit off of that too. So it's really like he is building in my mind like whatever anybody's personal opinions are on the privacy trade-offs required, like the first Bitcoin bank done right. And it just seamlessly connects those three different things together.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is for the people that are already using services that don't have, as great privacy guarantees as others. I still think that like this is going to be a really important service for those people, especially for ones that, like I think the main use case is for, if you have an employer who doesn't have any Bitcoin, but you still want to be paid in Bitcoin, this is a way to get paid in Bitcoin, and not have to, go through the process of explaining to your employer how to, set up an exchange account and what even is Bitcoin and how much do I get and all of that. This is going to make that a lot easier, which, at the end of the day, making it easier for people to get paid in Bitcoin rather than just buying it and trading it is, I think, a way more sustainable use case for the ecosystem as a whole.
Yeah, like I the like the flexibility of what you can actually use this for is really nuts. Like, you know, yeah, an employer could use it to pay somebody. I can use it as a person spending dollars who doesn't care about Bitcoin to just move my dollars, and the person receiving them, the business hooked up into that, can receive those dollars as dollars or Bitcoin. I can directly pay into from the native Bitcoin Lightning Network a merchant or somebody getting dollars on the end. People could use it as an on-ramp to just buy Bitcoin and send it to a native Lightning channel they control themselves. Like it's just a thing that fuck tons of people are standing around, and it creates seamless bridges between literally all of them for any use they want to put it to. And so, like, yeah, like I see the first Bitcoin bank done right. So, like, it would be really awesome to have a little more clarity in terms of the extra data collection thresholds that kicks into. And like personally, I just think Jack is probably overwhelmed with getting all of this shit going and just wasn't clear on that. You know what I mean?
I hope that's the case, because the situation with I don't know if you saw it, but there's like a ATM company that's been around for several years called Liberty X, and they've recently, they did this whole announcement where, oh, you can buy Bitcoin at like CVS and Rite Aid and stuff in the US. That was a bit disappointing, because in the end you find out, oh, they actually do tons of KYC even for small amounts. Well, I mean, enough KYC and not allowing you to really have as much privacy as you think you'd have if you're just, buying Bitcoin with cash. And there was an interesting exchange between them and one of their users where they basically said, we can't even really tell you what our compliance policies are. We're not allowed to share that. I hope that that's not the case here, and because that would be unfortunate. But regardless, I'm going to be looking into it more, because I just think, if you're going to use this service, you should. I'm in favor of letting people be aware of, where their data is going.
But that aside, it's still, yeah, like I am excited to see a properly done Bitcoin bank rather than a million copycat clones of Coinbase trying to do this kind of thing in the worst way imaginable.
I mean, like they I mean I don't doubt Jack's intentions, and I can tell that he probably tried as hard as he could to make not only the service as easy to use as possible, but hopefully as privacy respecting as he could within the limits of the system that he's trying to connect to. And I don't see that happening with a lot of other exchanges. So I think this is still a win in terms of, we should be fighting a bunch of these assumptions. And I'm glad that he at least did that.
Alrighty though. I guess
Bring the flood.
yep. So this is the third I think attack on the Lightning Network in the last little while. This actually builds on the HTLC attack. I think we covered in the last or it was either last episode or 226 that Rene Picard disclosed. Or no, last episode is 226. Duh. But it kind of builds on that attack, which couldn't really be leveraged by the attacker to directly profit. They can just force somebody to lose money and direct that to a miner. And that also kind of implies if the miner is the other side of the channel, that gets a little more complicated. But this is kind of a more advanced variation of that, where there actually is the ability for the attacker, without the requirement to be a miner, to directly profit from this attack. And so pretty much what it's doing is playing the same trick of spreading out a bunch of HTLCs and payments after making a lot of connections to a lot of different nodes, and then routing them to its own node in another part of the Lightning Network channel graph. And then what the attacker does is releases the pre-image from his receiving node on one side of this, and then lets the pre-image release all the way back to his channels with all his direct channel peers with his other node, and he refuses to cooperate in updating the HTLC and then removing that from the channel state in a state update. And at this point, all of these channel parties have to now take these HTLCs and settle them on chain. And if you do this with enough nodes, you can pretty much spam up the mempool and guarantee that a large number of these HTLCs will not be able to confirm before the time lock on the refund path expires. And so if you do this with enough different channel peers, statistically, you actually can get refund transactions confirmed when they should not be, just by clogging up the mempool. And they actually ran some simulations based on different block weights, with a 1 MB block weight, 15 channels, and shoving up about 20,000 HTLCs or around there would be enough to pull this attack. And with the larger block weights, it pushes up to around 90 channels and comes down to around 7,000 or so HTLCs necessary. And you can amplify this attack kind of by waiting tactically for fees in the mempool to go down and then signing a new channel state with a very low fee because of that, and then waiting until fees go up again to do this attack. And because of the way the Lightning spec works right now, the person who funds a channel, which in this case would be the attacker, is the only one who can propose a new fee for the transaction that represents the channel state. The other side can only respond to that and agree or not. So yeah, pretty much the two ways to solve this, I think, are feasible, is just reducing the amount of HTLCs that are allowed in channels at any one time, or pretty much trying to lengthen time locks or introduce kind of a reputation-based web of trust, so to say. But yeah, Lightning is a pretty complex protocol and a pretty complex layer. And I have been, I don't know, I have not been in sync with a lot of the blind fanboying of it for the last 2 years or so. And it's these kind of issues that's why I wasn't so yee about every little thing, because these types of attacks, they were going to be found. We're going to have to figure out solutions to them, and there's probably going to be a lot of this over the next couple of years. It's a very complicated layer, and these issues don't mean it's fundamentally broken, but it's going to take a long time to really smooth it out so that there's not real exploitable issues like this. And that's just the reality of it. Alrighty. So this next thing is kind of a funny name. It's a proposal for a new structure for HTLCs called MAD HTLC, Mutually Assured Destruction. And so this kind of this builds off of a lot of logic really looking at long-term mining incentives and ways to bribe miners. And one of the things that's been discussed really a lot in different pockets over the years is the idea that as the subsidy goes down and fees become more and more of a miner's income, that it becomes more and more rational for miners to modify their software in a way that would pretty much recognize and even actively facilitate double spends, or kind of bribing the miner to resolve a second layer contract incorrectly on chain, just because that transaction is paying them more money. and actually, robustly customize their software to help facilitate those things because it would maximize their revenue. And now this is something that it's not something that's going to happen tomorrow, and you still run into the issue of if there is logic in the Bitcoin node at large that would prevent nodes from relaying certain transactions for whatever reason due to what they see in the mempool or how the mempool is being handled, then you need to find a way to directly get these malicious transactions to the miner. I knew those fireworks were going to happen eventually. And so, like, this is a long-term concern, but it's a very valid concern. And part of the problem with HTLCs is if things really go in that direction, the whole logic behind a hash time lock contract is that the hash being revealed allows the person receiving it to spend it before the time lock expires, allowing the person who is sending it to take it back. Well, if the network and the miner's software in that network evolves over time to facilitate these types of bribes, then that construct is broken if somebody with a refund, capability in an HTLC is willing to pay a miner more than the person with the legitimate pre-image to redeem it has. So that could break HTLCs. Well, the general proposal here is pretty much to add a second pre-image and another output to the HTLC construct. And pretty much the idea is that, we'll use Alice and Bob. Alice is being sent money. She still has the pre-image that, if she is able to get, allows her to claim atomically an HTLC being sent to her in Lightning's case. And so that's the same. And then Bob would have the time lock path to be able to take his money back if Alice never gets her pre-image. Now, that path now pretty much has a pre-image too, a different pre-image. And the idea is you add a third path that allows somebody with no key to spend that as long as they have both pre-image. And now, see, the problem here is one side now has the ability, whenever they want, to burn the money of the other side by releasing their pre-image too, which would allow any miner to just take that money in a transaction without needing any key. Now, this alone is broken because obviously it's just scorched earth. Either side can screw the other side out of their money whenever they want. So that doesn't work. So what you do is you add a collateral output as well that does a similar thing. And pretty much what they do is they link the pre-image releases here so that this second output can only be claimed after Alice legitimately claims or Bob legitimately claims the timeout. And it's also got a path where both pre-images can be claimed by the miner. And so now the idea here is that any side that would have an incentive because they are sending money to just burn the other person won't do that, because doing that now burns their collateral output to the miner as well. And so the whole idea here is to try to incentivize the miner themselves to kind of act like a watchtower, because with this collateral now, you could still just have one side burn the other side, but it costs them something now. So the incentive is not to do that. Now, I think Maybe that could work well, although it would have the cost of now an HTLC requires collateral beyond the payment. But you bring into the picture the fact that miners can be counterparties in a channel, and there's no fundamental way to prevent that. And the whole thing breaks apart because now there is a chance that by releasing that pre-image and sacrificing collateral, you can get that back as a miner by mining that block. And so, yeah, honestly, like their answer to that potential was to just create a bunch of HTLCs with this MAD design staggered through different time lock intervals to disincentivize miners from doing that kind of thing. And it's, at this point, personally, I do recognize in the long term, if the incentives play out that way, that this could gradually break the security guarantees of HTLCs as we know them. This MAD HTLC design honestly just seems ridiculously complicated. The collateral output requirement increases the costs of engaging in an HTLC. And yeah, there are already enough problems looking at like René Picard's HTLC attack where we're having weird incentive conflicts potentially between the Lightning Network's security guarantees and miners who are going to try to maximize profit. So something like this MAD design, which entangles those things even more, I don't really know what these guys were thinking. And they actually do a pretty in-depth game theory analysis. So you can read through that in the actual paper in the show notes. But personally, I don't know why this was even spec'd out and designed. This goes in a way that just lightning incentives and mining incentives just smash their heads together. And that's incredibly stupid in my opinion. Oh my God. I was talking for way too long, Janine.
Well, it's my turn now.
Yes, it is.
The cat needs to be airlifted out of the zone. Okay. Anyway, in my Bitcoin privacy newsletter that I published a few days ago, and then also in BD episode 223, I talked about Coinbase's potential contract with the IRS, where they were offering blockchain surveillance services using software. And potentially more than that, that was basically built by former Hacking Team people in the form of Neutrino, that was then renamed to Coinbase Analytics. And in the same database in which that request was found, a just government contracting database, there was another blockchain surveillance related request from the IRS that has since appeared. On June 30th, as part of the IRS's Cybercrimes Cryptocurrency Initiative, their Criminal Investigation Division put out a request, which is actually mentioned across two documents, for information about, quote, systems that will allow developers and testers to conduct search of distributed ledger transactions involving privacy cryptocurrency coins. There was kind of like a summary document of other types of information requests that they were putting out, and in that document, which was a bit shorter, they said currently there are few investigative resources for tracing transactions involving privacy cryptocurrency coins, layer two network protocol transactions, side chain ledger transactions, or transactions on distributed ledgers that are adopting signature algorithms that provide privacy to illicit actors. IRS CI, which is the crime investigation division that I mentioned earlier, is interested in examining applications which will allow an investigation to more easily trace privacy coins and other protocols that provide anonymity to illicit actors. This would allow investigations to be more effective as well as facilitate a higher level of deterrence by making it harder to conceal criminal activity. solutions would also provide investigative efficiency that is currently limited. And the privacy coins that are listed in the second document, which is exclusively about this cryptocurrency-related request for information, are Monero, Zcash, Dash, Grin, Komodo, Verge, and Horizon. And as you saw in that summary, they also list some second layer protocols like Lightning and also I think Plasma and Ethereum related ones. They also list sidechain protocols. Interestingly, they did not mention Liquid. They mentioned some other ones. And then finally, they list tracing challenges following the integration of Schnorr signature algorithm, which if you watch our interview with that we are going to be publishing related to Liquid and the snafu, I think that's coming up today. Or no, tomorrow, you said, right?
Tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow. So if you want to hear an answer related to that, I would listen to that interview. But yeah, so I found it kind of surprising that the IRS...
Did I just disconnect? Okay, you just lagged out on my end really hard.
Okay, what was the last thing I said?
IRS.
Yeah, so I find it interesting that the IRS is aware of Schnorr signatures and their use case for improving privacy. So that's going to be interesting going forward. Because at the moment, I think Bitcoin Cash is... I'm only aware of Bitcoin Cash having added Schnorr signatures, probably badly. I think we might have talked about that. But yeah, the rest of the document says we are primarily interested in an interactive prototype that provides a GUI for clustering transactions involving a user, similar to tools provided by companies like Chain Analysis, CipherTrace, Coinbase. There they are. An Elliptic, but for the privacy coins and obfuscation technologies. Two, associate user distributed addresses with distributed ledger. What? Associate user distributed addresses with distributed ledger. Okay, that's a bit confusing. Basically, connecting user addresses of, I guess, maybe services to addresses on the actual ledger. With entities suspected to be involved in nefarious activities, provide a library of distributed addresses associated with names of users engaged in known or suspected nefarious activities, provide OSINT, open source intelligence information / research about identified users, has a mechanism for sharing investigative research between investigators, and the ability to import export investigative data in various file formats, and also provide an estimate of the cost and return on investment. So that is kind of just a summary of things that they want this prototype to be able to do. But it sounds like at this point they're just making a request for information about services or tools that would fulfill this use case. So that's going to be interesting going forward.
Yeah. That's just not going to happen. Like, I don't think that they comprehend even a tiny fraction of what it would entail to run a system doing all that that worked. Like, you would need, first of all,
nodes. You need the NSA.
In way more than that, you need nodes for all of these systems with massive secondary databases around them. You need to parasitically insert Lightning nodes into the network and either run one of the biggest routing nodes or a bunch of little ones everywhere that add up to that and pull that timing attack or analysis attack that we discussed an episode or two ago. Then you need to do that for all these other secondary layers like Plasma on Ethereum and all these other shit coins. And then for all of the actual fundamental privacy tech, you are going to need expert cryptographers to actually build up comprehensive frameworks to pull off a lot of the theoretical attacks that have been spelled out and modeled in these systems and really improve the accuracy of them. That's what you need to do to not wind up bumbling behind everything like an incompetent joke. Like the resources for that, yeah, like I'm not confident that they'll be for sale for those types of employers.
Yeah, and also, I mean, you might be able to find a service that does this for some of these privacy coins, because a lot of them aren't actually that great when it comes to privacy. But some are better than others, as I've been talking about over the past several episodes, particularly with the contrast between Monero and Zcash. You're going to get a vastly different result if you try to do this. And the other ones are, I don't know, I don't think they'll compete well with that. But then when you're talking about Lightning and sidechain protocols like Liquid that has confidential transactions already, and then talking about Schnorr signatures, which is, so niche and not even implemented in Bitcoin yet. Like, this is such a niche thing that I anticipate what's going to happen is you're going to get a bunch of well, I guess because they listed off tools. They said similar to tools provided by companies like Chainalysis, CipherTrace, Coinbase, and Elliptic, but for privacy coins. That kind of implies that they're aware of the service offering of those companies, and they aren't up to scratch yet in what they're looking for, which is interesting because, like, I mean, those are the big ones. Like, if they don't do it, if they can't do it, they're gonna have a hard time finding anyone else who is actually, doing that kind of work that will be able to handle any of this.
Yeah, you have to build it. Like, in order for what that really would entail to become a reality, you would have to have a massive percentage of the IRS just become the Go Fuck Bitcoiners division and get an open tap on resources.
I mean, some people would say that the IRS already is a giant go fuck Bitcoin organization.
Well, no, they're people who stand around and say, let's go fuck Bitcoin, but they can't actually do it at scale.
Yeah, I mean, not in a technical sense, in a legal sense, they can. I mean, they fuck with it already in terms of their really, capital gains reporting requirements and all of that. So, and also classifying it as a commodity. Wait, yeah, IRS classifies it as, yeah. So that they're already fucking with it a lot by doing that, and that doesn't, that doesn't involve surveillance. That's just saying, well, this is what we require you to do, and it's really onerous and pisses people off. So.
Yeah, but requiring is one thing, being able to enforce is another.
Yeah. Which I'm basically, like I said, they have a chance if they basically just plug into the NSA, but obviously that's not exactly a viable thing because the NSA doesn't exactly work like that in terms of, you they don't want their abilities to be known, and they would kind of have to become known if they were to participate in this kind of thing, to the extent where you're actually like putting people in jail or something from the information that they're providing. So yeah, like I don't know how they're gonna do this.
Alrighty. So, yeah, I guess move along to the next one. Or do you got anything else to add?
Nope.
Right, so this is really more of just kind of a request for comments on the Bitcoin dev mailing list right now. And I implore anybody who thinks they have thoughts they might offer on the subject to go reply to this, because there's still no replies. But Jacob Swambo, one of the co-authors on the custody protocols using Bitcoin Vault's paper we covered a few weeks ago, that Brian Bishop and Bob McElrath co-authored with him, kind of put out this like just request for thoughts on a general protocol for distributing and delegating control over pre-signed transactions, and kind of just thinking through, you know, when watchtowers were first proposed, it was really just proposed as a solution for the Lightning Network and Lightning channels themselves in a vacuum. But it's really becoming clear over the last year or so that a watchtower is useful for a lot more protocols than just the Lightning Network. And so, you know, he's just kind of asking like for thoughts and input on like, how do you put together a protocol for that, you know, including things like, you know, a system for accountability. Like how do you create a reputational system that can incorporate, like, say, a proof that a watchtower acted correctly or honestly, or one acted incorrectly and dishonestly, and potentially even, you know, start to think through maybe financially incentivized layers of that, and not just reputation. But, you know, I think this is really an area that could use a lot more brain share and people thinking about, because, you know, right now all the watchtowers being implemented that are very, very basic are strictly confining themselves to dealing with Lightning Network, Lightning channel states, and the correct actions to take, which are a very limited amount of things to respond to and what to respond with relative to other things you could do. And so, you know, let's put some thought into this and not pigeonhole ourselves into having a bunch of scattered, fragmented, you know, networks of watchtowers that can only do one thing or participate in one protocol, rather than a single, more redundant network of them that can handle all of them. So go throw your ideas in the hats, punks. Alrighty, and next up, this is actually a cool little tool that Rusty Russell just hacked together over the last month or so at Blockstream. But it's a Python test framework for Lightning implementations. And so for not really technical people out there, it's pretty much just a program that hooks up to the program you're trying to test and just trips all the functions. It does all the things that it's supposed to do and mimics anything that those different operations would interact with, and just, you know, throw bad input, like serialize something wrong, just play with all of the different pieces of that and make sure that bad input or things called in weird ways or orders doesn't trigger bugs or behavior that's not supposed to happen. And the thing is, until now, there's really not a general testing framework. Each implementation has their own. And he wrote this specifically working with C Lightning now, but tried to generalize it in a way where it's very easy to add like new messages or events to test, so that it can be generalized out to the other Lightning implementations, and done so most importantly without a lot of you know, effort or really rewriting whole sections of things, just adding new procedures for the framework to test. And so this is going to be a pretty cool thing to see, because if people from the other implementations really jump on this and flesh this out, then we can have a single comprehensive test framework that's not only testing just an individual implementation per test framework, but a singular one that's actually making sure all the different implementations are interacting with each other properly. And given the nature of Lightning as a second layer, and the fact that like I am honestly there are probably a handful of Lightning implementations or libraries or things hacked together out there that I'm not even aware of at this point. And if we're going to have a huge diversity of different software like that, then for a protocol like this, we need a framework like this that makes sure they all work together properly. And that certain software interacting with certain other software doesn't break or do something screwy that could ultimately lose people money. Ooh-wee. Are we ready for the comedic break?
Yes, if you mean the, oh, if you are referring to the clubhouse, which a lot like Fight Club has rule, first rule, don't talk about clubhouse, and now it's been talked about and people are angry. But yeah, so basically on July 2nd, 2 days ago, some Vice media journalists published an article titled "Silicon Valley Elite Discuss Journalists Having Too Much Power in Private App." In leaked audio from an invite-only app, venture capitalists pondered everything they think is wrong with journalism. And the first summary paragraph says, just so, I mean, I don't want to get into too much of the details of like what went on and what was discussed, but they say during a conversation held Wednesday night on the invite-only Clubhouse app, an audio social network popular with venture capitalists and celebrities, entrepreneur Balaji Srinivasan, several Andreessen Horowitz venture capitalists, and for some reason, television personality, by the way, that was not my insert, they actually wrote for some reason. Television personality Roland Martin spent at least an hour talking about how journalists have too much power to cancel people and wonder what they, the titans of Silicon Valley, could do about it. So what was an immediate red flag to me about this story and this situation is that one of the three co-authors of the article is a guy named Jason Kobler. And Jason was one of the Vice journalists who did some not very at all ethical things with their feature, or attempted feature of Chinese maker Naomi Wu a few years ago. She goes by Real Sexy Cyborg on Twitter. And if you want to hear more about that clusterfuck story, check out BD episode 184. But basically, what happened in summary is they wanted to interview her about her work as a maker, or at least that's what they said. And so one of them went to China to interview her and, you know, see, you know, how she does her work. The problem is they were kind of suggesting or implying to her that they were also interested in investigating the various rumors that were going around about whether she was possibly getting help with the work she was doing and her personal life and things that she did not want to go into for a lot of very good reasons, given that she lives in China and some of those things that they were implying was happening could put her under extreme scrutiny by her own government. And so she understandably got freaked out by it and ended up, you know, trying to protect herself from the fact that they were going to publish a story that could possibly put her in danger from her perspective. And so what ended up happening is at the time she had like a Patreon account and that was her primary way of making money. She would post videos of her various work activities and stuff that she was making. And Vice, in retaliation for the fact that she did things to try to protect herself and made them look bad, basically ended up getting her removed from Patreon and basically eliminating her income. So she got canceled by Vice. So that is kind of the background context to this whole story, which at the end of the day, I don't really have a lot of sympathy for either side. But anyway, so to go into this incident in particular, Yeah, I wasn't really interested in being on the side of the journalist too much, because and also because reading the article, on one hand, I didn't really ever get the sense that this whole clandestine recording of this conversation, however it happened, and then subsequently publishing it in an article, was really ever justified by some public interest defense. Because the snippets of the conversation that they included in the article were actually quite boring, and there wasn't anything that was implying like criminality that was being exposed. So I just feel like this whole situation is like a bunch of relatively well-off journalists getting into a social media spat with a bunch of very well-off venture capitalists who are complaining that their portrayal in some journalistic circles is not what they want it to be, and very justifiably has a lot of terrible incentive mechanisms that I have myself criticized and hate to the core. But it just feels like this whole thing just kind of got blown out of proportion. And then from a legal perspective, Balaji personally has been kind of going on a crowdsourcing campaign for memes and legal analysis, and memes with legal analysis, I kid you not, in regards to whether the recording of this conversation and then the subsequent publication of quotes from it was even legal. Preston Byrne, I saw in particular, wrote a very long breakdown of the potential legal consequences, and basically, from his understanding of, I think it was Connecticut state law, which is where he is based, and he believes it may be very similar to other states, and not even as strict as probably California, which is where these participants or a substantial portion of them were probably physically located, and maybe the even service of the app is located. The people who did this might be in some hot water, at least civilly, if not criminally, under state law. And then if you could possibly get in trouble at the federal level as well, because if you have people in different states, that gets very complicated. Basically, at the end of the day, from a legal perspective, it doesn't seem like this was a great idea, and I feel like it was. These journalists took a big risk for basically no payoff. Like, I don't see what the public interest defense is for this piece other than, oh, look, some rich people are not happy with certain journalists, and they may do some things like, I don't know, take advantage of platforms that already have tons of control over a lot of people's personal lives. Maybe they won't get as much clicks to those articles anymore. Who knows? Like, I feel like this just made it worse. I feel like it just made the whole situation worse. And I don't really have a lot of sympathy for either side, because I feel like they're both wrong in a lot of ways. But yeah, this is just a crazy story. And the only reason it's really Bitcoin related is, well, Balaji was trying to crowdsource, like I said, memes and legal analysis, and he's offering bounties for people who produce them. And he's been tweeting for a number of years about wanting to fix journalism. And he himself is not a journalist. He's a venture capitalist, related to Andreessen Horowitz and that crowd. And I've just found it interesting that. Because I released my revision control journalism document for the first time in 2016, and I've subsequently published another one, and I've done an entire investigation using that model. And over all of these years, he's made a number of tweets about, how he wants to fix journalism that sound very similar to things that I have published in my revision control journalism document, like using Git slash GitHub, decentralizing control using cryptocurrency. I mean, I didn't directly mention using cryptocurrency for funding yet, but I did mention using Bitcoin as a time stamping anchor with open timestamps. Just a lot of things over the years that are very similar to what I'm basically doing, but I have a strong sense that he will probably not ever highlight that work at all because, well, there's the whole complicated thing with Coinbase. There's the whole complicated thing with the fact that he advocated for using NSA surveillance data to do contact tracing, COVID-19 policing that we talked about many weeks ago. So let's just say it's very unlikely that my attempts to actually do something about fixing journalism will ever come into play in this conversation.
Can't have shit bounce back on you.
Fix journalism as long as you're immune to it.
See, like that, I think is like the interesting thing here to me is like I see nothing but a hollow attempt to create journalists that are not antagonistic towards Silicon Valley, which has become a huge thing in journalism. You know, over the last, it's just like look at Silicon Valley. It really is like a barely muted down version of the dot-com bubble at this point, with a stupid app for this that explodes to billions of dollars, and then a clone of it, and then this other stu it's like it's absurd. And the media has really just kind of latched on to that as a thing to constantly poke at and have something to write about. And I think here is like that dynamic just ripping into a full-on rift that is forming between East Coast liberals and West Coast liberals in the United States.
Yeah, and I mean the reason that I don't really have a lot of sympathy for either side though is because like I mean the obviously these people who were secretly recorded or recorded without their knowledge, they're upset because this is a privacy violation. And I don't necessarily disagree with that, but at the same time it's like, okay, so you're saying the journalists like I mean there are a lot of journalists who they have very 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 poor respect for people's privacy, but does Silicon Valley have they demonstrated that they care about people's privacy? Because I don't get that impression. I feel like you basically have two sides who are screaming at each other about privacy, and neither of them really has shown that they respect privacy very much. Like Coinbase doesn't really respect privacy. A lot of Silicon Valley-based companies don't respect privacy. So, I mean, that's the reason that I'm not a fan of most things that come out of Silicon Valley because I care about privacy and I feel like they don't care about it as much as they should. So at the end of the day, it's like people complaining about privacy while being upset about the fact that their privacy deficient industry is not being treated with enough respect. Like it just, just it's a little off to me.
Yeah, it's just two groups of assholes forming out of a larger group of assholes because they're being assholes to each other too now.
Yep.
But yeah, it's
And
just.
I also go ahead.
No, you go ahead first.
I one thing that I found a bit, I mean, he probably didn't intend for it to go this way, but when Balaji referenced the fact that Jason Cobbler had attacked Naomi Wu in the general way that Vice Media attacked Naomi Wu. I found that to be a bit distasteful because it was almost like he was implying that his situation was equivalent to hers, which it isn't. Because, like I said, the conversation, from my perspective, that got recorded was very boring. Like No one's going to jail over what they said. No one's going to have any have any serious consequence from what they said. Whereas Naomi Wu, she literally got picked up in a van. She had significant consequences for what Finn did. Like they're not comparable situations at all. And you don't highlight the situation, that's fine. But to bring it up in this instance in the context of like, look how.
No. Well, a slight pause while we wait for Janine's internet to undie.
Okay, I randomly disconnected.
All right, we're back.
What was the last thing you heard?
Crap. I don't remember. My head is too full of stuff the last 3 days.
Okay, well, I mean, I think I got cut off when I was just saying like I don't think that the situation between these Clubhouse members and Naomi Wu is comparable, and that should be very clear because one side had some very serious consequences from what Vice did, whereas this is just kind of an embarrassing, weird, entitled social media spat.
Yeah, I think that's pretty spot on. I just think like it's kind of interesting, to see a rift start opening up between these different groups on the left side of things, so to say, here in the US. And yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see whether they keep growing.
Also, you know what would be a good thing to learn from this experience is that, Clubhouse is, I think it's a Silicon Valley produced app. If privacy is a concern, they should maybe implement some features that better protect the privacy of their users. Like maybe they should they I mean it depends on how it was recorded, but maybe they should make it harder for this kind of thing to occur.
Alrighty. Ready to slide along into the last two for today? Did I hit the wrong button?
I heard, yep, we're ready.
Okay. So this is actually pretty cool. And I am not going to lie. I might be digging through a box for an old iPhone to play around with this. But fully noted. Just dropped a massive update on July 1st. It's pretty much a iOS app that hooked up to your own node in the back end and was just like a remote control for a wallet running on your own full node. And it pretty much everything was completely hosted on the node you were running, the private keys, the whole wallet and everything. And the app was just, like I said, a remote control for it. Well, in this new update, they are pushing a whole new architecture for their wallet. Although you can still use things like they worked previously with everything on your node and just using this as like a dumb remote. But with this release, they are dropping the fully noded wallet on the iOS, which actually hosts the private keys for the wallet on your phone, your iPhone, and actually stores the seed encrypted in the secure enclave on the iPhone. And now, this is nowhere near the same thing as security, specialized wallets, air gap devices that are not your phone and constantly hooked up to a cellular network. But this is an interesting in between that and just sitting on a computer waiting to get wrecked. And it just connects to the back end and shoves a watch only wallet on there. And does PSBT construction on the node and then passes it to the phone to do the signing. So that is pretty fucking awesome in terms of, you know, there really isn't a lot of iOS software out there that strikes a nice balance between security, usability, privacy. And I think that this new version of Fully Noted just nailed that. And another feature that they have for this is recovery wallets that are using the same kind of mechanism as the Electrum BIP39 sweeper down the recovery paths that Janine was talking about for Electrum the other week, and can handle any combination of you know, derivation paths known to be used by different software out there. So somebody using this wallet is not going to run into issues of coins selectively not being available and so on and so forth. As well, hold on one second. They have actually kind of like generalized the way that you're generating different types of scripts with the use of the new descriptor functionality in Core. And this is flexible enough so that you can grab any key from any derivation path and generate any type of script from that, or scan the blockchain for any type of script from that key. So, for instance, if somebody for some reason got your public key down a BEC32 derivation path and then made a legacy script and spent to this, this wallet will be able to handle, you know, recognizing that, finding that, and facilitating the right metadata in a PSBT so that any kind of signing device can sign with the appropriate key. So this is actually a really impressive generalization in terms of like that this is just really flexible in terms of what is in the user's control to do with their private keys or their addresses. And I think it's a real nice you know, kind of option to have a phone house the keys in this way if you don't have access or don't want to spend the money on a special purpose hardware wallet. Like, this is an interesting option that is paired very well and insanely flexibly to your own full node. And you know, I am not personally aware right now of a other wallet out there that supports in a simple way that type of generalized script generation from a public key. Want to just dive into the Electrum release and then I can go get drunk.
Sure.
Alrighty, so Electrum 4.0 is out. And I am sad to say that I have not yet had a chance to tinker with it because I have to upgrade my node and get an Explora instance running to be able to use the Lightning Network stuff privately. So that's probably going to be a project over the next few days. But going through the release notes, there is a lot of really well done design choices, in my opinion. So obviously, you know, to reiterate, you need a full Electrum server for this. So you should either pick a server that you trust not to lie to you, one that you know the operator of, or run your own. But it requires the full server to actually track the channel output status and such on chain. So sadly, not compatible with EPS. They're supporting static channel backups right out of the gate, though. So that is pretty awesome. That's usable to kind of get the other side of the channel to force close if you lose the most recent states for any reason. There's also rolling those into a simple backup file that can be moved around pretty flexibly, including through QR codes. but all of that information is encrypted to the key from the wallet's XPub. So you can only really import that and decrypt that from a wallet using the same mnemonic seed. All the Lightning stuff is enabled in the GUI. Just flip the stuff on. There is the Watchtower integrated. And support for you to hook up to a remote watchtower or configure your local watchtower in order to allow people to remotely connect to it. And also, this I am a huge fan of. And real quick, they do not have multi path payment support yet, but all channels are private by default. This is not going to forward any payments, so it won't participate in routing if it's online. And by default, it will not serve any gossip queries. So like a node's asking other nodes about peers or what's going on with the network, it will only consume them from other sources. So it's set up in a way to not be very open in what it will advertise or reveal to peers on the Lightning Network at large. There's also in the GUI submarine swap support. And this is actually a central backend server that Electrum Technologies is running. So it's baked right in there, but that's something you should know. It is actually the legal entity of Electrum running that. So something to keep in mind. And beyond the Lightning stuff, they have shifted everything in terms of unsigned transaction handling to PSBT. So there is no longer support for the legacy Electrum specific formatting for not finalized transactions anymore. So if you have multi-sigs, you got to upgrade everything, or they're not going to be able to talk to each other. This also had the compatibility fix for the latest Trezor firmware that broke everything. Multi-sig support for cold cards and Bitbox O2 support. And there's also going to be a decent amount of GUI changes, obviously, with all the Lightning and the submarine swap and stuff. And there's also been some changes in the output selection in the coins tab in the GUI. Really, the only other big thing is I do believe that all of this Lightning stuff, to some degree, is also being rolled into the mobile app on Android. So that is also something that's going to be fun to tinker with. But yeah, it has been quite a while coming, and I think that the wait was well worth it.
Yeah, we have specifically been waiting for it since episode 195 when we mentioned that Lightning was coming to Electrum. Just had to put that in there.
Has been quite a while, but new toys! Yay! Alrighty. Yeah, I guess that wraps her up for the day. Got any final thoughts for us to go out on?
Yeah, so as many of you may be aware, yesterday was Julian Assange's 49th birthday, and unfortunately, he had to once again spend it in prison in Belmarsh. But luckily, if you haven't seen it already, there was a couple weeks ago, there was an interview with his fiance and two children. About how they've been affected by this whole case. I think it was on 60 Minutes Australia. So I recommend watching that if you're not aware of the fact that he has a family who is being affected by this and children who are being kept away from their father. And there was a really cute video that she released yesterday showing them not only making some birthday treats for them to enjoy themselves, but they also sang happy birthday to him over the phone. So it's good that he at least got that human connection while he's in there.
Yeah, that's probably the most important thing in those situations, is not lose all that connection.
And my general final thought, given that yesterday was his birthday, and also I was, you know, in general just having conversations about journalism and what the best path is to follow and how to improve it. And you've probably seen that I said on Twitter, I borrowed a phrase from Samurai because they say on their website, build the Bitcoin privacy software that Silicon Valley would never build. And I rephrase that as practice the journalism that they will only ever tweet about.
Mm-hmm. And well, I guess I'm just going to go out with a cryptic statement. You can't stop flags from fading eventually. You can stop ideas from fading. So happy 4th. Catch everybody later, punks.
Bye.
Hele aller stanser i møyt. Fåsner, det seng et kjøsens rød. Jeg fått sryhet i sidene. Jeg sner i de søkmer jeg.